The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
This morning I'd like to share with you on the topic of ambition and ability. Ambition is one of the most misunderstood, puzzling things that we can see in our world today. It's the ambitious man who gets ahead, and it's the ambitiousless man that we don't want anything to do with because he doesn't do anything. And so it's one of these things, if you have it, you're wrong, and if you don't have it, you're wrong. There's a little story about a health class. A teacher asked a six-year-old boy what he did to care for his teeth. And he said, "I just watch out for kids who shove at the drinking fountain." And that is just a little bit the way we are in terms of ambition. We just watch out for the other guy who shoves. If any of you have been around a system like the military where there is a competitive circumstance for various ratings, I can remember many instances of ambition, but I think of one. The man who came to a place where I worked when I was in the military, and he came in, he was below the zone selectee for lieutenant colonel. He came in with a very high reputation, a brilliant man, and he came in and was just friendly to everybody. He shook hands, went around and buddied with everyone. Within about 3 weeks, you saw him start to narrow down his friendship circle when he found out who were the important people to know, who could serve him. And over a period of a year or two, you found that very likely he was out primarily to benefit himself. He went to a very good assignment, made full colonel. A lot of his buddies who he had sort of worked with, and they were on various projects and scientific research, he encouraged them to come where he was working, and they expected the same little crowd, you know, the good friendly bunch. And one of the men rather sarcastically commented after he went there, and he says, "Well, the only place I ever see him is in the John. And there's no contact. He has sort of used people." It was the classic situation of a man getting ahead for himself and trying to use other people. When I was working on my PhD, the man who was head of my committee said that the name of the game is to climb up and pull up the ladder after you so no one else can get there. Claw your way to the top, even if it means stepping on someone else's head. And that's the way the world operates. You know, watch out for number one and make sure that you get the credit. I picked up an advertisement for a book, and it was a book on how to sell yourself and how to get a raise, how to get ahead in your job. And it gave all the steps of how to prepare your boss and how to get the right ratings and how to set the stage and how to present yourself and how to blow your own horn. But you know, on the other hand, there's the totally ambitionless person. Many of you have seen the comic strip High and Lois, and you know the comic strip character Thirsty, who's the next door neighbor, and he is over there with his grass this high and a rather this kind of a beer belly and a red nose, and he's always yelling at his wife to go get him another beer. And he does nothing. His work is terrible. His house looks like a shambles, lazy, no goals. And it's the typical Archie Bunker, I guess you might say, that you could imagine. No ambition whatsoever. And we despise it. We despise the one who's outwardly ambitious, and we despise the person who is outwardly ambitionless. We don't have time for either. We struggle back and forth in our own motives between the two. We have had many illustrations throughout all of our careers, I believe, as to people who have been filled with ambition and people who haven't. In the Christian community, frankly, we reward the results of ambition. And no matter what the Christian community may be, whether it be the pastorate, a church staff, an organization like the Navigators, or any other group, there is always a structure in it. And any place you put a structure, you have an up or out type of system, in a sense. And there's always the push to go up in the organizational structure. Now, it doesn't matter whether the organizational structure is made up of 5 people or 500 people. There is always the temptation to have a status placing. In our churches and in Christian circles, we generally approve those who are successful. We have people who have title and position or education, and somehow we put our stamp of approval, even as a Christian group, on that person and not on others. So we reward the person who has had ambition, as long as we don't know what brought him to the point where he is now. It's kind of like the person who is attempting to get rich. We look down on him. But when we meet a rich person, we say, boy, God has blessed him. See if we haven't seen the process. And you see that happen again and again in churches and organizations and everywhere. And it's in many ways a misinterpretation of Scripture. So in ambition, we have a dilemma. The classical things of ambition are money, position or rank, and power. And not one of us as Christians is immune to that kind of a circumstance. So today I'd like to try and go through a study in the Scriptures with you on what ambition is, whether it is good, whether it is bad, and where it fits into the Christian's life. And then I'd like to compare ambition to ability. And I'd like you to feel free, again, to ask any questions. I'll try my best to wind up a few minutes early so that we can have some general questions and get into some of the things you've probably been wondering about from it. Let's go first just to a plain definition of ambition. The very tone of the word has either a bad or good connotation depending on your background and your sensitivity to it. But if we look at a definition from the dictionary, it simply says that it is a strong desire to gain a particular objective, specifically a drive to succeed or to gain fame, power, wealth, etc. A strong desire to gain these various things. And another one is the objective strongly desired. Now, one conclusion that I have come to, and I'll give you the conclusion before we get far through the study, that is that ambition is neither good nor bad. It is absolutely neutral. Ambition, in a human sense, is neutral. For instance, hunger is not bad, is it? But to excess, it becomes gluttony. Desire is not bad. Desire is one of the best motivating factors we have. But yet it can become craving, and then it becomes bad. Love is not bad. We preach love. But in the extreme, it becomes lust. Ambition is not bad, but in the extreme, it becomes selfishness and pride. Paul said in Philippians 3:10, I press toward the mark for the prize of the upward calling of God. So Paul had a goal. If we summarize the results of all this study, I'll give it to you like this, that ambition is not bad, but it is simply a matter of, one, the goal. That is the rightness of the goal to which you are pushing. If it's a goal to win the lost, it's a goal to have perhaps power in some way, that might be bad. Whatever the goal is will establish somewhat its rightness. If it's a goal to be rich, it's probably wrong. If it's a goal to give to God and so God blesses you, then it could be right. But the second thing is even your motives in reaching that goal. You see, you could have the right goal and the wrong motive. You could have the goal to reach the world for Jesus Christ and have the wrong motive by saying, and I want people to know that I'm reaching the world for Jesus Christ. And I want God to use me in this certain way, and I want to be known. So even though you have the right goal, you could go about it with the wrong motive. Now, the only goal from Scripture that I can see that is absolutely right is to serve Jesus Christ. But now everybody will agree with that, and if we stopped at that point, every one of us would be dissatisfied with this time today. If I just said, You've got to have a goal that's right, and you've got to go about it in the right way. And the only real goal is to serve Christ. We would all go away with an empty feeling in our stomachs saying, you didn't tell me anything. And so let's go on and divide the discussion today into two sections primarily. One is the evidences of illegitimate or unhealthy ambition, and secondly, the evidences of healthy ambition. And if we get these two things in perspective, perhaps we can apply it to ourselves in some way and be able to come to some conclusion. Because really, we aren't interested in just a Bible study. We're interested in you learning how to judge your own particular motives. So the first thing in illegitimate ambition is what I call serving your own ego as a bad motive. In Jeremiah 45:5, it says, "Are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them." God has no place for a Christian on an ego trip. One person has said that an egotist is not a man who thinks too highly of himself, but one who thinks too little of others. Now, ambition that is focused on personal ego will never, never have God's blessing. An illustration of that is Saul in the Old Testament. He was jealous of David's success. In fact, he was jealous of anybody else's success. And because of his focus on his own ego, he could not even obey God when God pointed it out so clearly. Two times, David had an opportunity to kill him, and David let him know that he did not do it. Saul repented and said, "I'm sorry, you're right, you're the man God has chosen." But Saul turned around because of his ego trip and went right on trying to keep the kingdom in his hand, even when he knew that, in fact, God had told him through Samuel that the kingdom has been torn from your hands. The second area is a motive to have position and power. In Matthew 20, 25 and 26, and I'd like you to turn to that passage if you would, please. Now, this incident is when the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons and asked a particular wish, and he said, "Command that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit one on your right hand and one on your left." It's an interesting passage. You at first want to blame the mother, and certainly the mother is to blame, just as we as parents often have wrong ambitions for our children or want to live vicariously through our children. Or a wife may have wrong ambitions for her husband and find her ego trip in her husband's position. Now in 25, it says, "But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave.'" And he gave the illustration that, you know, here's how it happens among the world. They lord it over one another. This motive to have position and power, and Jesus said, "But it shall not be so among you." It's a grasping for power, position, or authority that has in it the seeds of death. Every time that I have seen this occur, it eventually brought about dissatisfaction to the person. And even in a Christian organization, you see it. Or in a church. You can see within the church a struggle for power going on. And if any of you have been deeply involved in Christian activities, you'll see it going on all the time. Now, to just say it's there is being honest. To say it's okay is wrong. Because when a person is grasping for position and power, then when they don't get it, there will be bitterness and resentment, and they'll generally leave the fellowship. But over a period of years, there have been a number of circumstances where, even in the Navigators and in other organizations too, there have been men who have been either removed from a particular position of responsibility, rarely because of sin, but generally just because of their particular gifts and abilities. And he just goes off and is fulfilled in whatever God leads him to. The other person fights it and claws after it and leaves, bitter and disillusioned. The question is for each of us, if you have certain abilities that will allow you to be in a position of influence anywhere, in a church, in a business, or anywhere else, what will you do when you no longer have that? Because somebody will come along who can do that job better than you. And in the military, I think of how that goes. There will come a time when you no longer are promoted or when you run into a job that you cannot do well. But that gets a little into the area of ability. And so when we want to have power and authority, then we have to be careful. Peter Drucker, who is a management specialist, states this: the man who stresses downward authority is a subordinate no matter how exalted his title or rank. But the man who focuses on contribution and who takes responsibility for results, no matter how junior he is in the most literal sense top management. And so anytime we look at ourselves and we think in terms of authority, either over our children, over our other employees, or over our wife or husband or whatever it may be, then when we have that as a grasping motivation to have position and power, we will run into difficulty in our own personal lives. There's a little quote I got from a thing called Bits and Pieces by Henry Ford. He said, the question, who ought to be boss, is like asking who ought to be tenor in the quartet. Obviously, the man who can sing tenor. And there are abilities that each one of us have, and one of the greatest struggles of our lives is to figure out where our abilities and capacities lie and make our ambition to match simply using those. And I think the key in this is that we concentrate on contribution, not on position. Now, that's easy to say. That's a Christian thing to say, especially in the Christian community. Oh, concentrate on contribution. But what about in the secular community? What good is it to contribute? Society seems to be rotten anyhow, and all you're doing is making enough money to keep bread on the table or something. Yet, I believe there's an issue that if you focus on contribution in your job, and instead of ambition to push someone else out or to be better than somebody else, to be good is fine, to be excellent is fine, but to be better than someone else, that area of competition, is where it gets us into trouble. If we focus on contribution, several things will happen. One is, we will be blessed by God. Secondly is, we will have a witness among those with whom we work, because they will not see us as a threat. And thirdly, if God wants to put you in a position of responsibility or authority in your job or anywhere, in church, wherever it may be, then God can do that. In a book called The Velvet Covered Brick, Howard Butt says this: presumption clutches for leadership too fast. Despair shrinks from leadership it already has. And so again, there's the balance and the tension that we need to see what God is to do with our particular abilities and our particular gifts. The third area of illegitimate ambition is the desire to control others. In Matthew 20:25, again, you see, the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And then later it says they exercise authority. The world's pattern is to control people for personal goals. There are very few people in the non-Christian world who will actually try to serve just for the purpose of serving and doing a job and doing a job well. But most people want to control people and have that inner urge to change their thinking, to manipulate people, and to control them rather than to influence them. Now, you must make a very careful distinction in this. There are times when you're in employment where it is right for you either to control or to be controlled, because there rests a responsibility with your employer to accomplish a certain task. Now, the key again is the motive, that desire not to so much get a job done, but to put control over other individuals. You see the difference? See, that desire to control someone. There are many times in a home you will see that in a husband and a wife controlling their children in such a way that is not biblical discipline and it is not proper training. But there is that thing that the person may be in his job totally controlled by other people, and so they take it out on the kids and the dog and the dog and the cat. That desire is resonant within each one of us. We all want to control someone else because it gives us a feeling of power to be able to say, do this, and it gets done. But we must guard that. By the way, even David, who I used in this previous example, tried to manipulate Uriah. You remember that in the incident with Bathsheba? Tried to manipulate the circumstances of war, of all things, so that Uriah would be killed, and then David could take his wife. So even David, a godly man, made an attempt to manipulate for his own benefit. The next area of illegitimate ambition is money, a motive to be rich. Now, there are several passages on this. Proverbs 23, 4, and 5 is one that I think is worth looking at. Do not weary yourself to gain riches. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone, for wealth certainly makes itself wings, like an eagle that flies toward heavens. And basically it says that if you try and get riches, it'll just fly out of your hand. Have you ever had that experience of having a windfall of an income tax return or something, and you're going to use it for yourself because you just desire money, and all of a sudden all four tires go bad, or something happens that just eats up that money and swallows all of those intentions that you had? And by the way, it does not take very much to make a person desire riches. You can have little or you can have much. Some of the people who are least desirous of riches are those who are very wealthy. In Ecclesiastes 5:10, it says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, and he who loves abundance with his income. This too is vanity." And then in 1 Timothy 6:10, you have another teaching on money. "For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, and some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many a pang." I have a friend who I've known for about 18 years now, and he's a guy who in my early spiritual life really helped me grow. He would ask me questions that would make me think for days and deepen my convictions, because I would go into the scriptures and try and grapple with some of the hard questions he was asking. He kind of wandered off into a philosophical situation where he started wandering away from the faith. And he stated to me several years ago that his goal in life is to become independently wealthy, because then he can do what he wants. And he is working night and day to become independently wealthy. In the meantime, he is not happy. His 15-year-old daughter has run away and is involved in drugs and is now having to live in a foster home. And he is not wealthy. The key is, why does anyone want money? Why do you want money? And now all of us want some money. All of us would like to do this. I don't think there's a person here who wouldn't like to have just a little more. And that's the answer, of course, to how much money is enough. It's always just a little more. The key is, why do we want money? Now, part of the focus and the problem is our focus on materialism in the West. Now, I think there is a misconception among Christians, and it's so subtle that it just sort of comes in underneath and sneaks up on us, and that is that we equate God's blessing with material blessing. And on this trip that I made last fall to India, this was probably brought to my attention more than anywhere else. There are people throughout the world who are godly people, who are obedient, who have great abilities, but who are very, very poor. The Bible does not describe material blessing as a result of spiritual obedience. That is a possibility. But there are probably many Christians who are materially successful who are not walking with God. And certainly there are many non-Christians who are vastly successful who have no relationship to God at all. I think we need to rethink our focus a little bit on the fact that if you are obedient, you will be blessed materially. Now, I do believe that God will meet our needs as Christians. I think that is a promise of Scripture, but I don't think we may have abundance. And just because God meets our needs doesn't mean we need a house or a new car. That is not our needs. What that is our wants. We can live in a very small circumstance. When I was in junior high school and before in grade school, my parents lived in such a small little place that when I drove by one of these units last week when I was up in the Northwest, it's now made into a motel, and it would make Motel 6 look like a mansion. These little things, there was just a one room where there was a wood stove and a little place to eat, and then there were two very small bedrooms and a bathroom. It was, the whole place was about half the size of this room or less. It didn't occur to me that that was a problem. It didn't make a bit of difference to me as a child whether I lived there or whether we lived in some other place. And I saw places that were nice. Where we lived did not matter as far as I was as a child concerned. I think it did to my folks to some degree. But what is our focus? Would we feel bad if we lost our job and had to cut down our standard of living by 50%? Could we do that? You know, there may come a time that we have to. And by the way, it may be of God that we do cut back and give. Because the Day of Missions is taking some very unusual changes with inflation overseas, inflation here, and various things that are happening. Decisions are now being made that we can't afford to send certain missionaries to some places. So I think we need to be very, very careful in the area of being rich and to be careful in our jobs that that is not our motivation. The next is the area of personal competition. Now, I can't remember whether I mentioned something on this before, but in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself." In James 3:16, from the Phillips translation, it says, "Never act from motives of personal rivalry or personal vanity." How do we react when another person is beat out, either by someone else or by ourselves? And we know that competition is just that in the business world. One wins and another loses. Now, competition is one of the greatest motivators, and I would hate to eliminate competition from our circumstance. I love to play handball, and I like it better than running because there is competition. And there is certain adrenaline that comes to the system in the area of competition. So where does competition become bad? Adam Smith, in a book called The Money Game, says this: "You could take away all the trophies and substitute plastic heads or whale's teeth, and as long as there's a way to keep score, they'll play." Now, I would say that most men in here don't like to play a game in which you can't keep score. And most women don't care what the score is. And there's a different level of how you gauge competition. Both have the same problems. Howard Budd, again, in The Velvet-Covered Brick, says we get leadership by two alternatives. One, we get leadership by proud, competitive rivalry. Or two, leadership by humble, individual service. Now, I believe as Christians, we ought to compete against God's standards for our lives, a standard of excellence and our own goals, but not against other individuals. I think in a job, you should do the best job you can and leave the evaluation to someone else. And when another person with whom you might be in competition is in trouble or has needs, help them, and if they get the credit, fine. God keeps score, not man. But if you get involved in this thing of competition, it will just eat your lunch. and there will be a circumstance where you will not be able to live with yourself, because you may win for a while, but there will come a time when you'll lose in that competition, and you will not know how to handle it, because all you're doing is reaping the fruit of what you have sown and the way you've lived. And God has no interest in stepping in at that point, because He'll be very faithful and allow you to go through that process that He wants you to go through in understanding the fruit of your own actions. The last one is one that you may not encounter too much, but I think I ought to include it, and it's a motive to be served. In Matthew 20:28, it tells again that the Lord didn't come to be served, but to serve and give Himself a ransom for many. And the passage that we just had in Matthew 20 says that if you're to be first, you're to serve. But many of us feel that after a while, we sort of earn the right to be served. It's kind of like a parent raising a child, and after the children grow up and get away, they believe that the kids ought to serve them and support them. I know one woman in my group of relatives who held that over her son for years and practically broke up two marriages because she insisted that she was to be cared for and doted on and what have you by the sons. And finally, one of the sons actually kicked her out of their house, said, "You cannot come back into our house again." And I know the woman, and she would sit down with me and would try to tell me how the Bible, she'd go to the one verse that said that the children ought to honor their parents, and push that to the end and try and get me, even as a younger child, to approve what she was doing. So that motive to be served is something that we cannot use. Now, we got one fellow here, it's from the Academy, there may be some others. The whole system at the Air Force Academy is built on the premise that you serve now to be served later. You know, you go ahead and put up with being a dually for a year, because next year you're going to be on top and crunch. And in fact, you'll go through the whole 4 years because you know that one time you're going to be on top of the heap. And anybody will serve knowing that the results of serving now will be that they can be served later. And that is an ungodly motive. Now, I'm not blaming the Academy. It's the only way you can get the system to work when it's a non-Christian society. But for Christians, the motive is not to be served, but to serve. Let's stop there for just a moment, and let's just open it up for questions, and then I'll go into the evidences of healthy or legitimate ambition. I recently had an incident where someone felt that they should not have a particular job, because they knew their own ambitions. The better you know yourself, the better you can make a judgment. Now, the fact is, you might take the position, but it may eat you up. It may take 20 hours of your 24-hour day and consume you, give you ulcers, ruin your ministry, and hurt your family. But you could do the job. I would say definitely yes, it is right at times to turn down certain positions of responsibility. And the more mature a Christian is, the more clearly he understands his own gifts and ability and is willing to say, "No, I won't take that," and to turn things down. In fact, I know a man, a British officer, who recently turned down the British Command and Staff College, and he was the first one in the history of his branch of the RAF to ever turn down Staff College, and he was the only one who was selected that year from his branch, as I understand it. And it created quite a furor throughout all the Royal Air Force, because he turned that down, feeling that God did not want that for him at that point. He knew it ruined his career. I mean, that was it. You know, that was the death knell on the system. But he felt led by God. Okay, any other questions? Yes, Doris?
I talked to some parents who really...
Well, as far as being in competition, where it becomes bad is where they're out to get someone else, rather than it being a motivational factor. I think competition is part of us, just like ambition. And I think competing against oneself or competing against a standard or even competing on a team does things to build in self-discipline. But you have to watch the motive as to why the competition should be there. No, I believe that children should be taught to operate in a competitive society. and how to do their best. What we want to do, at least from my viewpoint, is to prepare them not to compete against another individual and rejoice in the downfall of someone else, but simply to do the best that they possibly can do. There's some definite conflicts. I think everyone heard the question. I'll just put it back on for the tape here. Was for a salesman and a real estate salesman, security salesman, that all these illegitimate motives seem to be very high on the list. Only having been in sales for a very short time at one time in my life is a little difficult for me to give a definitive answer, but I believe that we can have pure motives, and from the outside it will often look different. You know, you can still be aggressive, you can still go after the business, you can still be very, very competitive, but as long as you are walking with God and are being honest in your dealings and how ethical you are in how you compete, so to speak, or how you do your selling, I think will be the key issue. And it doesn't draw you down in terms of aggressiveness. It just changes your goal. Money may result, position or something may result, but your goal is different. And that if you have the ability to do it, I believe that God will bless that ability as long as our walk with Him is right. And I've seen this, an insurance guy that I talked to 2 weeks ago, who is a new Christian, where he's just really trying to be honest. The secretary in the outfit sort of reamed him out because he was getting too high a commission. Well, he's trying to be honest for the company and trying to be honest for the customer and get a balance in what he could charge as the commission because of a large business deal, and he could pretty well set whatever the premium was. She thought he was trying to make too much money. I said, well, you're going to have to live with being honest. It'll show out over a period of time. Bob?
Having dealing with salesmen all the time from the other end, from the buyer's end, I feel that there really is a way in which God blesses a salesman when he commits his life to Christ, because his interest is no longer promoting himself, but trying to serve, genuinely serve the person. You know, you have that happen to you once, and it's so refreshing, it sticks in your mind, and when you do need the product, he's the guy you're going to go back to. So the honesty, the sincere desire to serve that Christ should develop in a salesman, I think would probably benefit him in the long run.
Oh, I believe it would too, and most businessmen know, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to comment that the aspect of contribution, if you believe your product or your service is indeed a contribution to your customer, and operate on that, and be honest enough to acknowledge when it is not, mm-hmm. then the aspect of competition, again, is against the standard, not against the other person.
Right. I believe that if we are honest, we are going to make out. I had a circumstance, again, when I was in India, where it is common practice to cheat on the final exams, only one exams in 4 years, basically, and everybody cheated. And the Christians are at tremendous disadvantage because they can't cheat. And we had one student that we dealt with when we were over there that had cheated on his exams, and he was having to go in and renounce his degree. But yet, spiritually, honesty, a walk with God will do anything. You know, that peace of mind is so much better than anything else. Many of you know that some of the things that I'm sharing during this time are in a book that Mary and I have relating to the Christian and work. And Craig, there's one whole chapter that we have put in there on the salesman and some of the problems that he runs into, especially in the area of ethics. It's by no means definitive, and there's still a lot of open areas because there is no cookbook thing. Every man has to get down and pray over what he ought to do in this circumstance and what is right and what is wrong. Well, listen, let's press on for just a moment and talk a little bit about legitimate ambition, because there really is legitimate ambition. The first ambition that is legitimate is to serve, and to serve in two contexts. One is to serve God, and the second is to serve people. In Colossians 3:23, it says, "Whatsoever you do, do heartily as unto the Lord and not unto the men, for it is the Lord God whom you serve." So it is God that we serve, and that's the highest goal, but the other one is to serve people. One of the fellows that was in the Philippines recently said he asked a Filipino, "How long does a water buffalo live?" He said, "Well, if you make the water buffalo serve you 10, 15 years, you serve the water buffalo 25, 30 years. And the idea there is that if you serve God will bless you. Now, our foundational motive is to serve God, not me, not your organization, not anyone else. You make the focus toward God. And then the next motive is to serve one another. The second area is to be an influence. And I believe we can influence society. Abraham influenced God to not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah under certain conditions. Now, the conditions were not met. But God said, fine, I won't destroy it if there are 10 righteous in that city. Men and women, I believe that God's blessing to a great measure on some of our organizations that we work for, our employers, and so forth, are because of the presence of Christians. One man recently pointed out that the story of Joseph in the Old Testament, of how he served Potiphar and then served the jailer and then served the Pharaoh, that one of the things that was key in that is that Joseph sought to prosper his employer. And that brings the question, is your employer prospering because of your presence? Are you making your employer to prosper? And if you think, well, I can't really serve in such a way that society has changed, it's hopeless. There is a Filipino woman by the name of Lu Ming in the Philippines. She's an architectural engineer and is in government. And in the process of her work, she uncovered in a contract that was to be let, she did the design and then the contract was bidded and was built. She went out to look at the buildings because she saw that the bid was super low and she said it can't be built for that. She went out and found out the contractor had moved the building onto a property that did not need to be a landfill, but it wasn't government property. But he could do it much cheaper, and through a bribe arrangement between him and the government bidder, or the one who lets the bids, they could both make some money. She called his hand on it, and they said, just keep your nose out of it. Your job's wrong. She sent a memo on up the line. It was bounced back and said, mind your own business. She pursued, and they said, listen, if you pursue this, your brother is going to lose his job. So she prayed with her brother. They said, we're going to pursue it anyhow. Sent a memo on through the governor. The contract was rescinded and it was brought back. And it became such a thing that she effectively cleaned up that whole section of the government such that nothing dishonest can slip by her desk anymore. She is now, instead of falling down and being kicked out, she is put in the job of the administrative assistant to the direct assistant to the governor of the province for urban planning. And she has just been recently given a job to run a governor's conference for all the Philippines. And in the process, she was told that she was supposed to supply prostitutes for this conference. And she said, I'm sorry, you've got the wrong person, I quit. And they said, oh, no, we want you to run the conference, we'll eliminate that. And went on. Now, what I'm saying, if you are competent in your job, you can influence the honesty of the situation. You may lose your job, and she may still. But nevertheless, we have that responsibility before God. The next is to be a witness. It is right to be a witness for God. We're to be lights in the world. And that is our main purpose for being in a job other than just making money to buy food. We are to be a witness for Jesus Christ. So the question is, are we witnessing by how we work? Let me make one other comment on this business of influence. You rarely can influence by criticism. A quote that I have here is, you cannot antagonize and persuade at the same time. And what really influences is production or fruit of your life in a Christian concept. Results persuade. So how do you influence people? One is by prayer. Secondly is by results in your life. Third is persuasion to get someone to change a company or whatever it may be. And so you can influence where you are. A very good ambition is the ambition to be used by God. And there's a tremendous amount in the Scriptures on a man desiring to be used by God. 1 Kings 19 and 2 Kings 2, if you'd note those two verses. Elisha came as he served Elijah, and he says, grant me a double portion of your spirit. Now, wasn't that presumptuous? No, it wasn't, because he asked that he be used by God, and God granted that. Solomon said, Lord, give me wisdom to govern this great people of thine. And God not only gave him wisdom, but he gave him riches and authority. Now, God will bless you if you have a deep desire to be used by God, but there are three conditions that you must fulfill if you are going to be used by God. One is, you cannot tell God how you are to be used. Secondly, you cannot tell God from what position you will be used. And thirdly, you cannot tell God that you must get the credit. Do you see those three things? You can't say, now, God, I want to be used by you, but I want to be an evangelist, and I want to do this, this, and this. Or I've got to have this position, and then, by the way, I have to get the credit. I want everybody to know that I'm being used by God. Or, for that matter, for you to even know that you're being used. There are many times in our lives where God uses us where we don't know. The next right ambition is to lead spiritually. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but 1 Timothy 3 gives the qualification. You are leading whether you want to or not. Every one of us leads somebody because people observe our lives. So we must concentrate on leading. Thomas Watson said, "Nothing so conclusively proves a man's ability to lead others as what he does from day to day to lead himself." The next is the desire to use your gift, the ambition to use your gift. Romans 12:3 and 1 Peter 4:10 is the two references I'd like to give you on that. Ambition exceeding your gifts is presumption. But gifts exceeding your ambition is cheating the body of Christ. And so there is that balance that goes between those two things. Now, in addition to the gifts that you have, you need to consider the extent to which you have the gifts. You may be an evangelist, but yet you're not a Billy Graham. You may be able to lead a few, but not many. You may be able to teach, but you're not Howie Hendricks, you know, in your ability to do it. So there are varying capacities in the area of gifts. Now, as we compare ambition to ability, Socrates says we're to know ourselves. In Romans 12:3, in the Phillips translation, it says, "Have a sane estimate of your capabilities." In the Living Bible, it says, "Be honest in your estimate of yourself." We seek truth about ourselves, but truth hurts. We say, "How'd I do?" And then if anybody says anything wrong, you just get sick inside. You know, it doesn't matter when I teach, when I speak. If Mary is there, I'll say, "Well, how do you think that went?" But she probably better not be too direct with me, because I don't really like to hear the total truth, because the truth hurts. So we need to want to get evaluation and be willing to accept the truth, to be honest in that estimate of ourselves. And in fact, in our own self-image, we vacillate between an inflated ego and an attitude of worthlessness. And we need to come to some area in between. We need to know our gifts and to know our limits. There's an old Arabian proverb that says, "He that knows not and knows not what he knows not, he is a fool. Shun him." Confucius said, I don't know whether Confucius said this, but that's what my card says here that I wrote this quote out on. "Know what you know, and know that you don't know what you don't know." That is the characteristic of one who knows. And then another says, "Be very slow to believe that you are wiser than all others. It is a fatal and common error. Where one has been saved by a true estimation of others' weaknesses, thousands have been destroyed by a false appreciation of their own strength." So it's very important that in this area of ability, that we begin putting ourselves in a perspective of what our gifts are and making our gifts and our ambition come into focus. Now, even when we know we have a high gift in a certain area, that is a gift that really can be used by God, we must be patient to wait on God to use it. And then God may only use it in strength for a few years and then back you off into some other area. We can't tell God how, when, or to what extent he will use us. Let me mention just a few common problems as we close in the area of ambition. One is overwork and overambition. We just push ourselves so hard and we're ambitious beyond our abilities. Second one for some people is that they like the job too much. And they're just get so involved in their work that they do not give time to their family. The next that is a common problem in ambition is the pressure to produce, and it just eats us up. And the last is a job which is beyond our training or capacity. Now that last one, a job beyond our training or capacity, is one that is not easy to grapple with because we all want to feel that we can do anything. But there may be times when you move into a job which you really can't do, and you ought to admit it. So the conclusions that I would say in this area of ambition and ability is, one is to jealously guard your motives. Guard those motives before the Lord. The second is to focus on contribution and not on position. And the third is, make your ambition God's, that is to reach the world and to grow as a Christian in Jesus Christ. Philippians 3:10, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus.
Thank you for allowing us the privilege of ministering to you by way of this cassette. You can multiply this ministry by sharing this cassette with someone else.